all this is adding some ordinary scalar matter. With the right potential to a massless gauge theory. It gave us a very new kind of beast. It gave us, in the case of the massless matter, has a potential that takes it away from the origins, gave us a theory of massive gauge bosons. Or rather, massive spin one bosons. And I framed this in a language of the spin one bosons eating the Goldstone boson so that it looked like there wasn't any gauge symmetry anymore. I'll just remind you how that works a little more generally, because we actually only looked at this whole phenomenon of eating, of actually losing the scalar kinetic term. We only looked at that in the case of the abelian gauge theory. So for a non-abelian, I'll just repeat it in a general non-abelian context. Do it specifically for any particular theory. Just write down some Lagrangian with an f mu nu a squared. Sorry, I was going to label this guy alpha d mu phi a d mu phi a minus some v of phi. So alpha here labels the adjoint representation of the gauge fields. And phi and a labels whatever representation I've chosen for the phi. It could be one of many. I labeled it, notice I put this one half here. So I want to make the choice. I can always break down the representation into real fields rather than complex ones. Just want to do that for concreteness to handle the general case. So then, under the gauge transformations, phi A goes to e to the ig omega a, x, your gauge parameter, ta, sorry, these are alphas, again, living in the adjoint, t alpha's a representation matrix. It lives in the ab space, whatever representation phi is. So I can label this whole, think of this whole thing as an ab matrix times phi b. And because t is Hermitian, and necessarily pure real, IT T is Hermitian and anti-symmetric, which means that IT should be an anti-symmetric real matrix. Yeah.
I mean, it's a complex object. So shouldn't you have Hermitian conjugates for one of the D's?
So in general, I should. This is what I was just bubbling through right now. So my point is, if phi is, I'll go through that in a minute. If phi is real, then it must be that this matrix is real, this e to the I t, even though it looks potentially complex. So in this representation, IT has to be a real matrix and Hermitian. And T is Hermitian. So IT is real means T is pure imaginary and Hermitian. So T is pure imaginary. Once I've broken everybody into real fields, and if I write capital T to be equal to minus I times little t, or plus I times real t, then capital T is anti-Hermitian and real. In other words, it's anti-symmetric and real.
Can you write bigger?
Sorry, yes, I can. It's a little. So T alpha is I times little t alpha. It's anti-symmetric and real, because IT by construction has to be real. T by definition has to be Hermitian. Right, so if IT is going to be real and anti-Hermitian, it's also anti-symmetric. And so in terms of that, I would just say that phi A goes to e to the g omega alpha of x times t alpha AB phi B. Some representations are purely real, and so I'm just writing everything this way to make sure that I can accommodate those in addition to the complex representations. So now when we look at d mu phi, that's going to look like a del mu phi A minus IG A alpha little t alpha, which again carries an AB index, phi B. And now, again, you see I have this combination IT. So I can replace that with minus GA alpha, capital T alpha, Y, eighth component. Right, and so now actually d mu phi in this representation is manifestly real, because I can group the I with the imaginary T matrix into a real generator. So now let's give phi a vacuum expectation value. Let's write phi A equal to some phi naught A plus a script phi. So this is the vacuum expectation value, and this will be a perturbation. I'm not going to write it in an exponential parametrization, just because I want to keep things totally general. These are all the possible fields. If we now look at d mu phi A, keeping only linear order in the dynamical field, so I'm going to keep linear order in script phi and linear order in A, those are the two that are going to come up. That is just del mu script phi A minus G A alpha T alpha. Now I'll just go to the vacuum piece, phi naught A. So yesterday what we did is we dropped this piece. We just used this one in specific cases to conclude that we got a mass term for some of the gauge bosons. Because it looks like A alpha times G squared now let me transpose this, phi 0 transpose phi 0 T alpha transpose, phi alpha transpose T alpha transpose T alpha phi 0. So this A alpha, A beta, if I just take the all I'm doing is taking one component of the d alpha, another component of the d alpha. So this here is a mass matrix, M alpha beta. It has some eigenvalues. And however many non-zero eigenvalues there are, those are the massive components of the gauge boson. Now we know massive gauge bosons have more degrees of freedom than massless gauge bosons, so they better be eating something. We can see what they're eating just by keeping the linear order terms. So suppose alpha, some particular alpha, is an eigenvalue of this mass matrix. So then we have m alpha squared times a alpha squared times a half coming out of our kinetic term, plus cross terms, well, minus cross terms that look like 2g a alpha phi 0 transpose t alpha transpose this carries A and X, del mu by A. And so this is going to pick out, then plus we'll have the del mu by alpha, by A, squared terms. I can complete the square and write this as 1/2. Now I'm going to use the fact that capital T was anti-symmetric, just drop the transpose, change it to a plus sign. 1/2. Here, this is again anti-symmetric, so I could have exchanged. So this is really minus m alpha beta, where the m doesn't have the transpose there, and that should have a minus sign. So I can write this as minus 1/2 m alpha squared times. Now I want to complete the square. A alpha minus G phi naught transpose T alpha del mu, and I can bring the del mu out front. Script phi A. Okay, so if I put all of this guy in brackets, divide this by MA squared, you can see that the cross term in this expression is going to give us precisely this second term, up to maybe a minus sign. And
excuse me.
Yeah?
What? Why did we drop the phi, the curly perturbation times a term?
So that's there. I'm just trying to work out terms that are quadratic in the fields, in the dynamical fields. So I dropped, so that would have been, so I'm taking linear terms in each piece,
okay,
in each phi. So that would give me this.
Wait, m alpha, you mean m a?
And so, sorry, m alpha, in principle, this could have different eigenvalues. So by NA, I meant N alpha. So this is the mass, I'm now treating, assuming alpha as an eigenvalue, and or A alpha as an eigenstate of this mass matrix, eigenvector of the mass matrix, and then N alpha is its eigenvalue, N alpha squared. Now if we look at this last term, so this shows this here, I can just call A alpha, it's some particular linear combination of the states that I'm interested in, right? Some particular linear combination of the script phis that gets eaten by the A alpha. And now I have to subtract off this quadratic piece which is just a del mu A alpha del mu A alpha by definition. And if you look at this matrix, you'll see that the sum of all the A alphas is really just giving you a that these are canonically normalized kinetic terms. So when you subtract this off from the del mu phi A squared, you're really just projecting out individual, you're projecting out these A pieces out of the phi matrix kinetic terms. So this is the norm of the phi kinetic term. With the A alpha projected out. And when I say that, you have to make sure that A alpha is a sort of unit norm linear combination of these script phi alpha fields so that it really, you know, deserves to have, would correspond to a canonically normalized linear combination over here. And you can check that because this phi t, g phi t, is precisely the, when squared, cancel, is precisely an alpha squared. And then, so if you were to sum over all the a's, this should give you, right, I'm saying that a alpha squared is equal to g squared phi 0 transpose ta tb by 0 transpose.
So then be over m squared, m rather than m squared.
Well, there's an m squared out here.
Yeah, but...
Sorry.
But when you square this there...
Are you asking about... So this needs to be an over m squared so that the cross term doesn't have any m's in it.
Okay.
Right, the cross term, we fix the m squared by matching that. And then I'm saying when you look at this, the square term, it's going to have some phi A, phi B linear combinations weighted by something that's basically an m alpha squared, divided by, we have times the m alpha squared prefactor, and divided by another m alpha to the fourth from the denominator. So, sorry. I mean, really what this A alpha squared is this linear combination of phi's times divided by m alpha to the fourth. This grouping is m alpha squared. And then we have the m alpha squared in the numerator that makes this independent of m alpha squared. And just some sort of some unit norm linear combination of the phi's.
Just checking, the last term, is that that's not a curly phi? That's just the last kinetic term.
I should write this as a curly phi, although, yeah, for consistency, I'll write it as a curly phi, then mathematically that's the same. Okay, so these are really all the, so these are, if phi had, if the A indices ran from 1 to n, and alpha from 1 to n, these would be the, say, alpha from 1 to k were the massive gauge bosons. Of course, for the massless ones, we'd better not do anything, and this transformation would have been ill-defined. So this is just for the massive, the k massive gauge bosons. Then this can be rediagonalized as kinetic terms for n minus k physical scalar degrees of freedom. So this is just to remind you how this eating works in a somewhat more general setting. I apologize for the somewhat confusing notation and haphazard placement on the blackboard. if you could work through this more slowly later on, it's not critical to the rest of what I'm doing in this lecture. It was just to show you that the eating still works in the non-abelian case, because that was something I had left out of yesterday's discussion where I was just focused on calculating the masses. But once you go through this, at the end of the day, all you have is some final Lagrangian for massive spin one particles interacting with, you know, maybe some scalar matter left over, maybe some other fermionic matter that you added. It's basically made up of some massive gauge fields. And I'm going to just assume everybody's broken for consistency. I'll keep calling these alpha. Plus some potential interactions that involve phi and a set together or separately, plus, you know, kinetic and gauge terms and potential terms for any other matter. So we can ask, just what if we had started from here? What if we had just tried to write down a theory with massive spin one particles in it? Would we have been able to work with that? And is this really the most general kind of theory of massive spin one particles that we can write down? So there's really two parts to this. The first part, where I can do at least somewhat concrete calculations right here, is just classical consistency of massive spin one. So we can really look at Feynman diagrams involving these spin one particles as intermediate states, as external states, and see what kinds of constraints there are on these theories if we want them to be well-defined classical theories, even up to really high scattering energies. In particular, are they well-behaved for energies much greater than the mass of the gauge bosons? In the process of looking at this, we'll see that the propagator structure of these theories actually makes the, and I'll be able to argue that if it has a domain of validity to energies much larger than the gauge boson masses, this theory really has to have features of a Higgs theory. But I should emphasize that everything that I've done up to now and everything that I will do in this discussion is classical. So there's a separate question of, are these theories even quantum mechanically consistent? What happens as you go start considering loop amplitudes? Apart from this classical argument, the other key reason to think about these Higgs theories is that they'll provide basically the only way to really understand the consistency of these theories, particularly in the non-abelian case, including quantum corrections. And working in a phase where you do, in a theory where you do have this gauge symmetry, even if it's hidden, will allow us to actually, has allowed people through some very technical calculations that we won't do in this lecture to show that Higgs theories are renormalizable in the sense that the high energy, that quantum effects can respect the structure of the theory. So I'll talk about this mainly in the context of Higgs theories. But this discussion of the classical consistency will hopefully help motivate why this is even a concern, which right now it wouldn't really seem to be. So To start with, I've got to talk about what are the Feynman rules for massive vectors. So you've never worked with them before. So to start with, we know that massive vectors have three polarizations. I'll just call them massive spin one polarizations. But we can consider the spin one particle at rest. There we all know what the polarizations are. So at rest, we've got a spin polarized in the x direction. Sorry, that's the z direction. Y direction. And x direction. These all have the two properties that we want of a gauge boson, that epsilon dot k mu, where k mu is just mass in the first coordinate, equals 0. And epsilon dot epsilon star is equal to minus 1. This is a standard normalization for polarization tension. Now, if we boost in the z direction, these two, the x and y polarizations, go through unchanged. So I'll call it epsilon y, epsilon x, or epsilon, like epsilon transverse 1, epsilon transverse 2, because eventually we'll want to think about boosts in other directions besides z. This guy, when we have a momentum, p mu, k mu, equals ek 0, 0, k, well, clearly not orthogonal to k mu anymore, but a vector that would be longitudinal polarization is k 0, 0, ek. And we're going to be interested in the high mass limit. So I can go ahead and write this as, I'm sorry, to satisfy the normalization, I'll want to divide both by the mass of the vector. So in the high energy limit, E much greater than EK, much greater than MA, I can write this as K mu over MA plus order, some leading corrections from this EK over MA are of order MA over EK. Right? So this longitudinal polarization, it's a little counterintuitive, but you'll see that it's true. In order to keep it orthogonal to k mu, as k mu becomes null, we need to make it more and more lined up with k mu. So it actually approaches something proportional to k mu. Another thing we'll want to work out is the propagator. And remember, how we got propagators. We got propagators by thinking about fields built out of creation annihilation operators. So if we wanted to group polarization, creation annihilation operators for a scalar into a field, we'd take phi of x equals phi plus of x plus phi minus of x for a real scalar. For a complex scalar, this guy would just also have a different label, where phi plus of x is equal to an integral d cubed p over 2 pi to the 3 halves square root ep times sum e to the I p dot x. Then here's the important part, a dagger p. Well, For a vector field, I guess Weinberg's convention is that this is an A. And I don't remember for sure which sign is conventional there, but we won't be using it. Question?
I'm a little bit confused what you said about the epsilon zero. What is epsilon lambda? Is that one of the original epsilon?
Epsilon, so lambda is a, so lambda equals 1, 2, or 3. Is just going to be an index labeling the three physical polarizations. So, I mean, when you do calculations with a massless vector, lambda equals 1 or 2. It's always just the transverse ones, and you sum at the end of the calculation over the epsilon lambda stars, right? Where the stars in this notation are completely irrelevant because we're using real polarizations. So this would be lambda equals 1, 2, and 3. Here I'm just labeling them as distinguishing between the transverse ones, which are the same, which are sort of analogous to the polarizations that you would use for a massless vector traveling in the same direction, and the longitudinal, which is the new one that you add for a massive vector. But in each case, lambda is just an index running over the three polarizations.
I don't see how lambda equals 1 works.
Huh? Sorry?
Epsilon 1, lambda equals 1 with k.
So at rest, so this was these were the epsilons for a particle at rest, where k mu was equal to m. Yeah, sorry about that. I see what the confusion is. M 0, 0, 0. Okay, these are the three polarizations for the particle at rest. So now you see how one works. And then when you change to a boosted momentum, these two survive. Epsilon 1 doesn't work anymore. You're right, as I was saying. So we have to find its replacement, which is this one. So when we do the same thing for a vector field, well, oh, and sorry, and then phi minus equals phi plus Pythagoras. And we do the same thing for a vector field. We're going to have a phi mu of x, which we usually call a mu, but I'll call it phi just to make the similarity clear. Phi mu plus phi mu minus. And phi mu minus of x will again be equal to phi mu plus dagger. Now, what's our phi mu plus of x going to be broken down into creation annihilation operators? Same prefactor. Times p dot x. Now, though, we need to sum over lambda, sum over the polarizations. We'll have a different creation annihilation operator for each lambda, and it gets multiplied by the polarizations. These are what make up what map us from the particle labels, which remember were little group labels, SO3. The rotations of a particle to a Lorentz label, epsilon mu. And actually, if you remember, in the case of a massless vector, there was a lot of tension in this mapping between epsilon mu and the labeling of the two polarization states. Because epsilon mu, they were tempted to define in some sense, either it didn't transform correctly under Lorentz, it didn't transform as a tensor under Lorentz transformations. Or it would have some unusual properties under the little group. If you don't remember that, it's fine. In this case, it all works much better. This epsilon mu can actually be defined as a tensor. Now, let me go back briefly. Why am I going through all this field business? Because this is how we got propagators. So the propagator came out of any time we wanted to do a calculation that involved a commutator of phi of x with phi of y, and in particular, if I took a phi plus and a phi minus, that commutator is inherited from the a's and a daggers, right? From the a and a dagger commutators, and those always have their canonical normalization. So that was just going to be equal to an integral d cubed p over 2 pi cubed times 2 e p times, and then we had our just p stuff. Okay, and this, if you wanted to make this look more four-dimensional, one can always integrate in a time direction and write this in the Feynman prescription as an integral d4p. I think it's still a 2 pi cubed, 2 pi to the fourth now, of 1 over p squared minus m squared with an I epsilon times the same exponential. Okay, so that's where propagators come from. And by that logic, when we calculate the propagator, we can just calculate the propagator for the phi mu fields, for our vector fields, our massive vector fields, by just going through the same logic. Right? So this is our scalar propagator. For a vector propagator, well, when we take phi plus mu of x, phi minus nu of x, that's going to give us that same momentum prefactor. Which we can reinterpret as a four momentum integral later on. But importantly, when we do the commutations of A lambdas, we're going to now get We're going to be left with a sum over lambda, epsilon lambda mu of p, epsilon lambda nu star of p, times now our usual exponential stuff, our e to the I p dot x factors. And so this forms the numerator of the propagator. So we can just work that out. We can ask if this is going to be a, we can check it in both of these cases, but if we just want to write down a candidate m mu nu, since it's built out of, for general momenta, it has to be, and I'm going to just fix the normalization of the first term, it has to be of the form minus eta mu nu plus b p mu p nu. Right? Those are the only Lorentz invariant combinations. Yeah?
In the equation defining phi mu plus, I think the epsilon should also bear the index lambda downstairs.
Thank you. Yes, it does. So we know, I've just fixed this coefficient for now, but we know that it has to have some form like this by Lorentz invariants. I can make these arbitrary A and B in general. Let me just fix that sign for now. The requirement that epsilon dot k equals 0 implies that also, sorry, I'm calling it p now, epsilon dot p equals 0, implies that p mu and mu nu should also equal 0. But we can just calculate, so this is going to fix B. Because p mu n nu, by direct calculation, is going to be minus p nu plus b p squared p nu. So for this to cancel, it had better be that b is equal to 1 over the mass of the vector squared. Okay, so now We see two things from this, actually. First, we know what mu nu has to be. And we know what the vector propagator is for massive vector. It's going to look like minus the usual term that we're used to. I think a minus I, although don't quote me on the sign, times an eta mu nu minus p mu p nu over m squared, where this is the mass of the vector. Now, notice that this has different power counting than everything we're used to. We're used to a particle having to, we're used to Feynman rules where bosons have 1 over momentum squared at large energies. At large energies, this propagator isn't dying off. It's growing. So this is something to watch out for. Also at large energies, those propagators, those polarizations, sorry, it's not growing, it's just going flat. Right, it just asymptotes to 1 over a squared at large energies. The polarizations are actually growing with energy. So this should make us wonder, when I calculate things at high energy in this theory, are they going to look funny? Okay. So does this look funny at high energies? So let's start with a simple example. Now I'm going to come back to the special case of the standard model. We're just going to think about left-hand electron, right-handed positron going into W plus W minus. And I'm going to focus on the longitudinal polarization of the Ws because that's where we
So I have a very silly question. So we have imposed the E dot P equals to zero condition to derive E. Like that. So, I mean, that's the condition that its momentum is transverse to the polarizations, right?
Well, it's, yeah, transverse in the Lorentzian sense, yeah.
And is that something we're imposing by fiat, or is that?
It's something that we need to impose in order to get three polarizations out, right? Because ANU has four components.
I see, okay.
The other way of looking at it is that if you just actually count in an F mu nu, you don't have a kinetic term for the zero component, right? Because F zero zero vanishes. So you're kind of forced to do something to deal with that term. The natural Lorentz invariant thing to do is to just go into Lorentz gauge.
Right. I mean in the massless case, you know, that's what we would interpret as the Lorentz gauge condition.
Right, which of course doesn't fix the gauge completely.
Right. Okay. And here.
So here we can think of this as still living in Lorentz gauge, as a way to make sure you only have three propagating degrees of freedom. If you start writing down the other.
But you need the gauge phase for the massive case.
No.
Well, you need to go into something. You need to gauge fix at the level of Lorentz gauge, right? You can't, or you somehow need to make sure that that other degree of freedom is safe, and not because what are you going to interpret it as? You have a massive spin one particle, three polarizations. You want to write down a theory involving 3 degrees of freedom, or you have a fourth degree of freedom and you render it safe by a gauge.
But the propagator thing is for its gauge fixed, but you could use the R psi gauge.
Yes. Yeah. So if you just want to talk about a massive vector from the bottom up and construct a unitary theory, this is the propagator you should write down. R psi gauges are, you know, very naturally introduced when you talk about a spontaneous symmetry breaking, but not when you work from the bottom up and try to write a unitary theory of a massive spin one particle. It's not something you'd introduce without the symmetry structure a priori.
Okay.
So I guess I wanna talk to illustrate the importance of the gauge structure for the consistency of the theory. We've got to look at some specific examples. And this is a nice example because there's a sort of bare minimum process that is just required in any theory of weak interactions mediated by a spin one particle, right? Because we know that we were using an electron W neutrino vertex in order to get the weak interactions. That same interaction forces us to write down this diagram, that this is a possible diagram for electron to W scattering. Now, when you work this out, I don't think I'll go into a lot of detail on the calculation because we don't have a lot of time, but each vertex, you know, is going to give you a G, right? In the end, what you end up with, well, not quite in the end, what you end up with is a G over root 2 from each vertex, and then some spinner product among left-handed spinners. I'll call this guy L minus, L plus, K minus, K plus. Oh, sorry. Other way around. Gamma mu times some gamma matrix crap. And then if I want to study this for the longitudinal W's, and to study the largest terms as a function of energy, I can go ahead and plug in my epsilon mu nu for the W's, for the transverse pieces of the W's, which are just, so this is the matrix element.
So what is LWL? What does L stand for? Yeah.
L is that longitudinal component, the one with the component that grows with momentum.
Whereas on the left-hand side, L and R stand for left and right?
Yeah. I hadn't noticed that, but yes. Call these guys longitudinal. So I can put in my approximations for the longitudinal polarizations, which are just k minus mu, k minus nu actually, k plus mu over mw squared. And you see this is something that's going to grow with momentum much faster than any, if we had put in the transverse polarizations, these would just be order one. Okay, so you could put in the k minuses here, here and here, do the spinner algebra. You can see pretty easily that inserting a k minus slash here and then using an equation of motion for the L minus, you could write this as a k minus L minus slash. That gamma mu, and that combined with this guy cancels off the denominator. So you lose your whole propagator denominator, which is the usual thing that makes these things smaller at high energies. You keep the and you still have this extra power of momentum with nothing to cancel it. So fast forward through some algebra, what you'd find is a matrix element mod squared. After you trace over the spins of the electron, that is proportional to g to the fourth over mw to the fourth times t times u. Okay, so this actually is growing with energy. And what that implies is that since the cross section goes like 1 over s times m squared, the cross section also grows with energy. This is not what we're used to In phi 4 theory, for example, the cross section falls with energy. And you can actually argue, based on unitarity, that partial wave unitarity, that sigma should be bounded at high energies by something that scales like 1 over s. In order for the theory to be both unitary, I mean to be unitary, if you're exceeding that, it doesn't necessarily mean that your theory is non-unitary, but it does mean that your perturbation theory is becoming non-unitary. That you would have to do some resummation or add new degrees of freedom in order to render it a consistent theory. So this matrix element squared, if this were the final answer, this would be problematic. And this would mean that this theory, as defined, doesn't really make sense up to energies where these matrix elements are becoming big. So at energies around mw over g, which is around the Vev of the Higgs, things start acting a little bit funny. Now, this is not the whole story in the standard model. In the standard model, we have other diagrams that go through an S-channel Gage boson to get us our W plus W minus final state. And here, again, in the standard model, we have two gauge couplings, one in the coupling to either of these two once we add them up, one in the coupling of the gauge bosons to themselves. Now, it's sort of most natural to think about this, except that we have to worry about this propagator. It's most natural to think about this in a mass diagonal basis, where there's just the A3, the last, at least, for the couplings. Think about the couplings. Think of this as just an A3, which is a linear combination of the gamma and Z, and the only one that actually couples to the W. It coupled with a strength G, and electrons coupled to it with a strength G. So that gives you the couplings. Then you have to worry about the massive propagators, although they turn out not to give you that different an answer than the massless propagator in this case. So the point is, this also has a matrix element that grows. In the non-abelian gauge theory, this coupling, the fact that these couplings are the same, allows these two diagrams to precisely cancel. But if we just had some random interactions between the massive bosons, or if we just had some...
So what term in the Lagrangian gives you the interaction between the photon and the W's?
So let me start that in two parts. So the interaction between, let's work in the gauge basis, right? So we had our F mu nu A for the SU2 squared. And since F mu nu has its del mu A type pieces, the commutator, minus a commutator of A mu with A nu, with the appropriate non-abelian factors. Square, that's going to give you, with the cross terms of this piece, in this case, it'll give you three gauge boson interactions for the non-abelian group. So the third component of the W has interactions with the W minus and the W plus. It was what we called A3 last lecture. A3 isn't a mass ion state. It mixes, there's a component of A3 in the photon and a component of A3 in the Z because it's mixing with the hypercharge boson. So both of these guys are mixing just through the SU2 part of their interactions. But the photon's part SU2, and that's why it couples to the W's. So this matrix element grows. If you work out the sum of these two, you get a nice finite matrix element and a finite rate of producing pairs of W's in the standard model. But if you tweaked the structure around, so that this three-gauge boson vertex wasn't G, you would get violations at high energies of this perturbative unitarity. So in order to have this theory make sense and have credible degrees of freedom, up to very high energies, significantly higher than the Higgs bed, we would need, and there is, as usual, there's a sort of 4 pi give before you really start worrying. 4 pi times the Higgs bed or so is where you would, where this theory would be breaking down. But in order to make sense of that, it must be that the 3-gauge boson, 3-gauge boson interactions satisfy, have the same strength parametrically as these. And the group theory is what tells us that it has to have the right structure. So it must be that the 3-gauge boson vertices have the gauge theory structure. Now, there's an even more dramatic example of this if we start looking at the scattering of W's off of each other. And this is something that's really unique to the non-abelian theories, by the way. Let's say we talk about W plus W minus going to ZZ. So we force ourselves to introduce 3-gauge boson interactions in order to make the matter interactions consistent. Now that we have those, we can write down, and in this case, there's only 2 combinations. There's the 4-gauge boson vertex, and there's TNS channel diagrams. Once we add these guys, we again have a matrix element odd squared that grows with energy. And you shouldn't be surprised, because you're sticking in lots of longitudinal modes, all of their polarizations are growing with energy. And again, you need something else to unitarize this scattering. So 3-gauge boson interactions saved the day in the electron scattering problem. What's going to save the day here? I'll just start by telling you the scaling so that we can kind of guess how this is going to work. The matrix element, I'll forget the mod squared, the matrix element grows with energy as g squared s over mw squared. Naively, you might think you have lots of 1 over mw's coming from all 4 of these guys, and so it's going to be a 1 over mw to the 4th, or even with the propagator, 1 over mw to the 6th diagram, but with, you know, k to the 6th. But enough of the k's actually dot into themselves that you end up getting only k squared over mw squared type of scaling. Now, to cancel this, turns out we need to introduce the physical Higgs boson, or again, something like it. One could always imagine a more complicated sector doing this, but you can also imagine having, you know, baroquely coupled new massive bosons, heavier than the W, a W prime, for example, that's going to mediate another diagram. So one can play with different ways of trying to cancel this. But in the standard model, but something has to cancel it. In the standard model, what that is the Higgs bed interaction. And it might seem a little confusing at first that this should have the same rate. So remember where these trilinear couplings came from of the Higgs. The Higgs had terms that looked like phi mod squared. Sorry, can you see that at all? We had phi mod squared a squared terms coming from the scalar gauge interaction. When we took one of these Higgs's to its bev, we were left with the physical Higgs times bev. These are proportional to g squared times the bev times g squared times a squared. So each of these is actually a dimension 3 interaction with a massive coupling, v g squared. which is precisely equal to mw times g. So what's happening is that we end up combining these with mw to the fourths. We've really got mw times g squared over mw to the fourth times s in the growth of this diagram. And again, when this proportionality is held, when the mass of the W is equal to what you'd expect from its Higgs cup, what you would get from the Higgs VEV. And remember, this equation is really using the dynamics of this Higgs theory very, very carefully. When that's satisfied, this diagram cancels off that diagram, these diagrams, at least in the leading pieces. It doesn't cancel completely. There's still scattering. But it implies large energy scattering. Really does go like 1 over s, as we want. So I mentioned that there are alternatives to a Higgs mechanism to unitarize this process, as it's called. You can add new spin 1 particles. You can add really strongly interacting particles that are so strongly coupled that in some sense they don't have you have no right to think about their extra degree of freedom as a fundamental particle. So it doesn't strictly have to be a Higgs, but it certainly does. Whatever mechanism you have certainly needs to have the structure of a non-abelian gauge theory at high energies with spontaneous symmetry breaking of some kind. If that's true, if the W and Z are good degrees of freedom out to high energies. I mention this because there are theories in nature, like QCD, where the degrees of freedom change. Right? It could be that the W and the Z are spin 1 resonances of some sector like QCD. That idea is called technicolor. The question then is, well, if those are the spin 1 resonances, why haven't we seen everything else? Why haven't we seen the rest of that sector? And why haven't we seen some hint of the strong dynamics in measuring the couplings of the strongly interacting particles in the theory, the W and the Z, and also the top, because the top you call is really big. So you can have some strong dynamics where the W and the Z aren't even the right degrees of freedom at higher energies. You could have a theory that just, you know, maybe the quantum gravity scale is at, you know, 1 TeV, and we haven't seen it. I don't know why. But it's logically possible that the theory just stops behaving like a field theory above that scale. Again, that's even more dramatic than saying it's a field theory with different degrees of freedom. And then you don't really need the W and the Z to interact in this particular way. Although honestly, that possibility should also have shown signs it's something, because it's such a dramatic change to the theory, you're really sensitive to it at colliders, and that should have been seen. So for tree-level consistency of the theory at high energies, we were really forced to introduce a lot of this structure. Yeah?
So is that, does that include theories with large extra dimensions?
So in theories with large extra dimensions, I guess there's an idea that's often talked about in the literature of having a cutoff near the TeV scale, where field theory stops making sense. Large extra dimensions are, or at least for our conventional theory, stops making sense. Large extra dimensions are one example of that. Going the extra step, and you can always push the scale up a little bit to the point where that's not constrained. What I'm saying is really difficult is going the extra step of saying, I'm going to have my theory cut off at several TeV, and not have anything in the theory unitarizing WW scattering. So I'm going to not have a Higgs. I'm going to just write down W bosons and, you know, not worry about this problem because I cut off the theory at a lower scale than where this problem would actually arise, this growth, where this growth would actually become too big. That sort of radical cutting off of the theory and throwing away the Higgs should have been seen, because that forces you to put the cutoff a lot lower. And I don't, at least I don't know of any way to avoid seeing that. But the question of whether the, you know, whether the cutoff of the theory is near right above our heads but not touching the skin of our heads, that's still open. So, all right, so this has taken up most of the lecture, which is fine. I wanted to briefly touch on this issue of renormalization. Now going back, so I was talking about, can we argue based on these tree-level consistency that a theory with massive Ws really should be a Higgs gauge theory? And if you want it valid to high energies, then the answer is really yes. So now we have a theory that's, if we adopt that, we have a theory that at least classically is a good theory up to high energies. And the next thing that we should worry about, which fortunately our forefathers, like Tufte and Veltman, already worried about a great deal, is this theory consistent also quantum mechanically up to high energies? And, I mean, I told you a few lectures ago that non-renormalizability in an effective theory isn't really something you should worry about. In that context, what we were talking about is higher dimension operators, things that are whose effects on a matrix element went like some k to the fourth over m to the fourth, gets strong at some particular energy k, and that's just a sign of new physics around m. Amount of mass scale m that would eventually make a more complete theory. Might still have some non-renormalizable interactions. Those would be completed at a higher mass scale. That's the good kind of non-renormalizability. A bigger problem would be, let's say you write down a non-abelian gauge theory. That gauge symmetry is restricting what kinds of interactions you write down. For example, it is, even though you're spontaneously breaking it, it's still non-linearly realized. It's still a constraint on the interactions. It's a constraint on, for example, the kinds of mass terms we write down. We are not allowed in this theory to write down the mass terms, just direct mass terms coupling the electron left to the electron right. That's forbidden by the gauge symmetry. And so we have to worry about, are there effects in this theory that are going to secretly destroy the gauge theory, the gauge symmetry? Just like, I mean, we talked about anomalies briefly, where classical symmetries of a theory aren't symmetries of the full quantum mechanical theory. And it would be really important to know, and really, really problematic, if we saw a Lagrangian that seems to respect this non-linearly realized SU2, but actually there was no theoretical reason why that would be protected. Actually, radiative corrections would destroy that symmetry. So the bad kind of non-renormalizability is actually a dimension, is actually non-renormalizability in the sense that you write down a theory that respects some symmetries, there's dimension four operators forbidden by the symmetries, or even relevant operators that are forbidden by the symmetries, are generated anyway. Also, any kind of, and here I'm going to be vague, any kind of, this would be an example where if these are generated, then you've got some sort of UV sensitivity in the theory that you don't really understand and don't have much control over. And we really have no right, in that case, to talk about these symmetries, symmetries like the relations of these couplings, actually being respected quantum mechanically, and at one loop being able to continue guaranteeing that the scattering is renormalizable. So there's a self-consistency check. And that self-consistency is actually incredibly hard to show in the gauge that I've been using. So I adopted that propagator, and somebody mentioned, well, what about the RSI gauges? Those are different. And I just want everybody to know what the RSI gauges are. So in general, in order to show that this theory is renormalizable, easiest to work in the path integral formulation, and you have the freedom to fix the gauge in the path integral in different ways. So when you fix the gauge in the path integral, you have some freedom, and a convenient choice of the gauges is parametrized by a parameter psi. Okay, and so what you find is the dark underbelly of the blackboards. What you find, I'll just tell you the propagators in these RSI gauges. In general, when you fix gauge in a gauge in a non-abelian gauge theory, even to limited effect in an abelian gauge theory, you have to introduce ghost degrees of freedom that actually cancel out some unphysical behaviors. So in these RSI gauges, you actually have three physical degrees of freedom that you keep track of. Or I shouldn't say physical. You have three degrees of freedom that you keep track of in your Feynman diagram calculation. The first one is the gauge boson. Has its usual mass term. And then this propagator should look a little bit familiar. Okay, so when the psi goes to infinity limit, this just becomes the propagator that I wrote down over there. Psi is a free parameter, so you pick a gauge by picking a value of psi. If you take psi goes to infinity, you recover that propagator, that's a unitary gauge. But you also have two other degrees of freedom. One is you keep track separately of a Goldstone boson. Propagator goes like psi ma squared. And the other one is actually called a ghost. So this Goldstone boson, we know it's kind of overcounting degrees of freedom. We have a massive vector that's got 3 degrees of freedom. This is introducing a 4th degree of freedom. And you can think of this ghost C as it's a degree of freedom introduced with the wrong statistics to kind of cancel the effects of that unphysical degree of freedom. You can't really localize. In the typical psi gauges, you can't localize whether that, you know, who that degree of freedom is associated with. Is it associated with the Goldstone, with the vector? It's sort of split between them. But this ghost cancels it out. So you can see a lot of different regimes here. If you take psi goes to infinity, we get our familiar A mu. It's called unitary gauge. It's a gauge where the only propagating degrees of freedom are the physical ones. That's how we constructed it. Because you see, these masses are going to infinity, which means the effects of the alpha and C in any Feynman diagrams would be suppressed. If you take psi goes to zero, then you're going to get massless Goldstone boson, massless ghost, and the psi effects completely disappear, so the propagator for A mu just has a K mu K nu over K squared in it. And that's another important gauge. Now, notice that if you take any psi that's finite, you get back to normal propagator scaling at large mass, at large energies, right? Because this, for any finite psi, as k gets big enough, k gets much bigger than root psi times ma, the propagator term goes like g mu nu minus k mu k nu over k squared, which is order one. It's not growing with k. So it's these finite psi gauges that let you show that in loops and in tree diagrams, but especially in loops where you have to worry about lots of insertions of propagators, this theory behaves safely. And all the naive power counting that you do of the degree of divergences in loops should hold. So those are the gauges that you need to use to prove renormalizability. You have to take this different gauge to show that all you've got are physical propagating degrees of freedom, and you're never going to get, you know, unphysical answers with some funny ghost field entering in a final state, for example. So different things are manifest in different gauges. That's okay. We do have the freedom to choose them all. But I just wanted to highlight that because it's a major aspect of showing that these massive theories really make sense. I know this last chunk has been a little bit heuristic. That's really all I was trying to do, is to make sure that everybody's aware of these gauges and that they play an important role in showing that gauge theories are renormalizable. All right, so that's it for today. I'll be around if you guys have questions.